So the Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Smith, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding. This is case number 820-1182 in the matter of the welfare of the child of HGD and JRQ.
Good morning. It's already December 15. Thank you for appearing by interactive video with the court today. The rules of appellate procedure apply, but for the fact you do not have to stand when you're making your argument, unless you feel more comfortable doing that. The marshal will have a timer. From my vantage point, it's in the upper left-hand corner. Please keep an eye on the clock. You'll each have 15 minutes for presentation of your case. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you choose to use that. Before you begin addressing the court, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. I also want to remind you that because we're engaged in technology, wave, speak, do whatever you need to do if you have some flaw on your end so that it will be called to my attention. With that said, appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Brooke Beskow-Warg, and I represent appellant mother HGD in this matter. Your Honors, when children and families are brought into the child protection system in Minnesota, their cases require full and careful consideration at every juncture in the case. This is a case where that consideration was not given. It's clear when reading the court's order, which contains either extremely limited or no findings of fact to support the statutory grounds in the petition, that consideration was not given here. Rather, both the county and the district court relied on mere speculation, which resulted in the removal of a child from her mother. Today, we ask this
court, just to make sure that I'm understanding how you're framing this. You're not objecting or making an argument that the absence of mother is the basis for the appeal, that it was labeled a default, in other words, proceeded in her absence. What you're arguing, as I understand it, is the sufficiency of the evidence as far as the state going forward, despite mother's absence.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. The district court absolutely had discretion under Rule 18 of the Juvenile Protection Rules to proceed in default in this case. Of course, at that default hearing, the district court had to take evidence into consideration to prove the petition by clear and convincing evidence. And the issue in this appeal is whether that evidence was sufficient to support the statutory grounds, the findings, and the disposition in that order. So today we are asking that the court reverse the district court's order adjudicating the child in need of protection or services and removing the child from mother's custody because that evidence was insufficient. As you noted, this order arose from a default hearing. We are not contesting the default hearing. Mother failed to appear. The district court did proceed by default, but the county offered very limited evidence to support the petition. We heard from only two witnesses, the child protection investigator, James Coulter, and the ongoing case manager, Bridget Moriarty. There was no other evidence offered at the hearing.
The child protection witness indicated under sworn testimony that the allegations in the petition were true. Why is that not enough?
Well, Your Honor, first, while he did testify that the allegations in the petition were true, the petition itself was never offered into evidence. We did not see the allegations in the petition. We do not know what those were as far as evidence goes. While he did say that they were true, there are certainly objectionable bases in the petition as far as hearsay goes. So it's simply not.
Well, perhaps that may be a best practice or a better practice, but couldn't the district court in this case, couldn't the district court take judicial notice of matters that are within the court file?
Your Honor, generally speaking, in child protection matters, the rules only allow for judicial notice of orders and findings of fact. A petition does not fall under either one of those. So we would argue that the petition could not, the district court could not have taken judicial notice of that petition in order to use it in its findings here at the district court. It's also notable that the district court doesn't seem to make any findings regarding that petition in particular. There are no credibility determinations regarding statements made in that petition. There are no findings that any given allegation in that petition is actually true. So we would contend that no, the petition, just because it exists, does not stand as evidence in this case to prove the statutory bases.
Were there any objections, counsel, to the question about whether, I'm sorry, I don't have the transcript immediately available, but was there an objection to the question about whether the allegations are true? Like a foundational objection or anything?
Are you referring to when Mr. Coulter testified to the petition? There was no objection at that point in time. No, there was not. Your Honors, when we have a child protection case, a CHIPS matter, the evidence received in support of the petition has to prove two things. Under In Re Welfare of SSW, there has to be both a statutory ground proven and also evidence that the child is in need of protection or services as a result. There must be a nexus between these two things. We must have that statutory basis, and we must also then prove and find evidence that the child is in need of protection or services. The district court erred here because the county did not prove any of the statutory grounds or that the child is in need of protection or services as a result. The facts presented at the hearing essentially established the following. The child was returned to the care of mother after mother had her home checked by the social service agency and the guardian ad litem, and after she submitted to a UA that was negative. There was testimony that mother's communication and contact with the agency was inconsistent. She did send multiple messages. There were some phone calls, so there wasn't a non-existent communication here. There was just inconsistent communication. The messages did give concern to the county social worker because they were somewhat late at night, and she testified that they did not make sense. They were out of context. We do not know the content of these messages. We don't know what was said. We don't know any of that context. None of that was given. We also know that there was a domestic incident involving mother and the father of the child. Mother notably called the police to report this, as well as the social worker. And there is no indication in the record that the child was involved or harmed in any way because of this domestic incident. Finally, there is also evidence, testimony presented that while mother provided two UAs, the county social worker struggled to get additional UAs from mother. There was no other evidence presented, and there was no other evidence received at the hearing. Under the first prong, we must find that there is a statutory basis for the CHIPS adjudication. Here, there is not enough evidence to prove any one of the three that the judge at the district court level found existed. The district court determined that there were three, as I said. Under 260C.007 subdivision 6, the district court found that subparts 3, 8, and 9 were all proved by clear and convincing evidence. Based on the evidence that I just recited, there is not substantial evidence to support a finding that the child was without necessary food, shelter, clothing, or other care. There was some testimony that mother at one point said she had moved her belongings to a new residence. And then there was also testimony that mother said she had not moved. So the only potential question here is about whether there was shelter. Again, mother at the end of the day said that she hadn't moved, that she was in the same shelter that she was in when the county came and checked to make sure that that was a suitable living space for the child.
Counsel, is it possible though that, I mean, I don't think that district court, correct me if I'm wrong, expressly addresses, but that it didn't find credible mother's statement after all the communications about I've packed up my stuff and gone elsewhere, and child protection officer saying, I want to come visit. And then she said, oh, okay, I didn't move. Maybe that just was simply not found credible.
And Your Honor, that could be the case, but we have no indication of that from the order. There are no findings regarding mother's home. There are no credibility determinations made here explicitly in the order. So it is hard to know whether the district court found that credible or not.
Well, here's my question then for you, and obviously Mr. Sweetheart's going to get the same question. So in terms of remedies, this is, look, I'm speaking only for myself. The panel certainly hasn't discussed the resolution yet, but if I agreed with mother's position, what happens? I mean, there was ample reason for the district court to be concerned about mother's behavior based on the ramp up to the eventual hearing. So what do you see us doing?
Your Honor, we are asking that this court reverse that adjudication. And essentially what that means is that there is not substantial evidence to support the petition. And in that case, the petition is dismissed.
Petition is dismissed, or does it go to an emergency protective care status? I think what you're asking is us to say this didn't happen, which would then force the county to, if there was need in a showing, to again begin with an EPC. And that's what I'm wondering, because it's a curious position in terms of what we do on these type of hearings.
And Your Honor, yes, we are asking that this court reverse. The petition would be dismissed, and the county would have the option of bringing another petition if it saw fit under the circumstances.
But counsel, let me ask, though, to follow on Judge Werke's question, which I have the same one, is let's leave aside the question about the sufficiency of the statutory findings. There was an order, was it not, that returned the child to mother subject to appropriate supervision. And if the district court found that supervision was thwarted by the mother, I mean, can you walk me through, let's just assume a scenario like that, that there's an order returning a child subject to appropriate supervision and the parent thwarts the supervision. What rules, what statute, what standard applies for that then to be revoked and the child returned to the custody of the county? You know what I'm saying?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure that I'm understanding your question.
Well, didn't the order return the child to the mother subject to supervision by the county?
The order at issue here transferred—
The previous order.
The previous order, yes. The previous order did transfer the child back to the custody of mother under protective supervision. That is correct.
Okay, and if protective supervision is being thwarted by mother, what's the county's remedy, and what standard has to be met in order to then reverse that? In other words, that order was not complied with, the previous order, I'm assuming for purposes of argument, the previous order is not complied with because mother is thwarting, let's assume that, and want to understand the framework for analyzing that, is thwarting protective supervision.
And I understand the court's concerns with the lack of communication here and the inability to exercise that supervision. Procedurally speaking, though, we are at a CHIPS adjudication stage. And if the court cannot find that a CHIPS adjudication is warranted, it seems unreasonable to yet again remove a child from the care of a parent when the county cannot prove that this child is in danger or that—
Do we have the authority then to permit or order a remand so that Judge Long could review what the testimony was, all of the testimony, and determine if she can create adequate findings of fact in order to adjudicate a CHIPS? Is that a possible remedy?
Your Honors, this court absolutely could remand for further findings of fact based on the evidence that was presented. There is no question here, I believe, that the findings are insufficient for this court to review. Of course, it's our position that a reversal is warranted here, given that under the testimony that was given at this hearing, there is still insufficient evidence to prove that this child is in need of protection or services under SSW and the statutory provisions.
So if this is reversed, what collateral consequences, if any, would befall mother as far as having an adjudicate, CHIP's adjudication and then having a reversal? Would that fall away? That's beyond what you're asking us, but it's certainly something that we're all cognizant of.
Your Honor, in terms of would the CHIP's adjudication or what was a CHIP's adjudication and then a reversal, would that affect mother in any way?
Correct.
And her case going forward? From my perspective, the case would essentially, if this was reversed, would start anew with a new CHIP's petition. I don't believe that that would have substantial collateral consequences for mother moving forward.
And of course, what I'm getting at is the difference between a remand and the record is the record versus a reversal, assuming we buy your argument.
Correct, Your Honor. And those two remedies are substantially different here as far as how the case would proceed to the next stage. It could potentially come back up to the court of, and I see my time is up. So unless the court has any other questions, I will end there.
You'll have your time for rebuttal. Thank you. And thank you for watching the time clock, Mr. Sweetheart. Oh, you're on mute. Sorry, sir.
Sorry, thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Terrence Sweetheart, Assistant Rice County Attorney on behalf of respondent. In this case, Your Honors, it's important to note that this is an appeal directly from a default judgment, which I think affects this court's standard of review of that default order. Typically, as the court's aware, the standard of review in a CHIPS case is that the court closely inquires into the sufficiency of the evidence to determine whether it was clear and convincing, and then applies clear error to the court's findings of fact and abuse of discretion standard to the findings for the statutory basis. I don't believe that standard applies in this matter. And also a related standard of review is that which is brought under 22.02 of the Juvenile Protection Procedure Rules, where an individual subject to a default order requests the court vacate that order under certain and specific circumstances. That's typically what happens in a case, is that when there's a default, the parties bring a motion under 2202 and then appeal that order, thereby allowing the court to apply the standard of review of an abuse of discretion for the court's order. Here, because it's an appeal directly from a default order, the standard of review is limited, as was noted in Nazer v. Nazer, which both parties cited in their briefs. That case specifically noted that our review is limited to whether evidence on the record supports the findings of fact and whether the findings support the conclusions of law as set forth by the trial court.
But isn't that the problem here? We don't have evidence on the record. Mother's absence is not like a money judgment default. Mother's absence is just that. So my question to you, of course, first and foremost, is why was the petition not introduced as evidence or supporting information extracted from your witness?
And I think, as you indicated in your question to counsel, that's certainly a best practice. Why wasn't it admitted? I think based on the default, the attorney believed, based on the case law, that those facts by virtue of default are admitted by the defaulting party. And
what case law in a juvenile protection matter would you point to?
Sure.
To say that the allegations, I mean, it strikes me that your position then would be there needed to be no testimony whatsoever.
Well,
the county put on testimony.
I think that there, to answer, I think it's two part of your questions. I'll answer the latter first. I think that the county still necessary for the county to put on testimony because to establish the circumstances at the time of the default order. So the petition only went through June 23rd of 2020. So then we need to establish what happened between June 23rd and August 14th when the pretrial hearing was held. Regarding citing to the case that references admitting the allegations in a default case, that's the problem I had was really, I think, because the typical procedure is to first file a motion to vacate under 2202 and then appeal from that. So I think there's limited case law regarding a direct appeal of a default order. However,
the case law that you relied on, Mr. Swihart, is cases that have to do with the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure and have to do with civil cases. And that's the difficulty I have in trying to unbundle what it is that you're attempting to do.
Right. So, and as I cited in my brief, there's the Thorpe Loan and Swift Company case. That case was then subsequently cited in an unpublished Court of Appeals case by this court, In Re Welfare of JLL, and I can provide the site, which is 2014 WL7011387, Minnesota Court of Appeals case, December 15th, 2014. And in that case, that juvenile protection matter cited to Thorpe Loan case for the proposition that...
I've reviewed your case. It's an interesting case. It's civil in nature, but how do you correlate, or how do you argue that case is applicable when you look at the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection 301, which says civil procedure does not apply?
Yes, I think I'm relying on this case in JLL, which says specifically that a party in default may not deny facts alleged in the complaint when such facts were not put into issue below. So that's a juvenile protection case from a default order. I recognize an unpublished decision, but I think still that when a party fails to appear at the hearing, or the pretrial hearing, to deny or to rebut the allegations contained within the petition, I think the case law is certainly applicable that those facts are therefore admitted, or at least they may not be denied in the subsequent appeal.
I understand, counsel, it's your position then. Let's imagine that the county's attorney had then moved to admit the petition after there was testimony saying, you know, describing it, saying it's true. Then are you saying that the mother's counsel could not have objected to anything in that petition on, for example, hearsay grounds or anything? There can be no objection to it?
I think she, yes. I agree that she could have objected. Then the court could have either sustained or overruled that objection, and then...
Well, she would have no sustainable objection. There's no way to object to the content of the petition on when the court goes forward and a parent has defaulted by not appearing.
I'm sorry. Are you asking whether I apologize.
I'm saying, you're saying you could object. I'm saying, is it a valid objection? It seems to me that you're saying once the parent is not there and the court decides to go forward under Rule 18, that's just it. It can't be denied. It can't be admitted. The facts must be the facts.
Well, I think if going back to the case I cited on JLL, which then cited Thorpe, it says may not deny the facts alleged in the complaint when such facts were not put into issue below. So were those facts by virtue of objection put into issue below? I think in this case there was no objection.
Well, they weren't offered. Was there an opportunity to object?
Yes, Mr. Coulter testified that all the facts within the petition were true and accurate at the date of the hearing. The opposing counsel could have objected to those facts, specific whatever facts she wanted to object to, saying, "What about that certain specific facts were not accurate?" She could have questioned Mr. Coulter about May 22nd incident, in which the mother was found intoxicated by the sheriff's office, or the June 5th, where she was living with an individual who had a domestic abuse no contact order. She did not.
Mr. Swihart, what is this court to make of the facts that mother's attorney pretty strenuously objected at the outset of the hearing to proceeding in default in the first instance? I mean, can we consider that or not, given the court's overruling of that objection and decision to proceed anyway?
Well, I think you can consider it, but in the context of whether it should proceed by default, not necessarily the petition that was testified to by Mr. Coulter. So did she objects to default because her client wasn't there. And then the judge indicates in its order, well, she received notice of the hearing. And then she asked Ms. Counsel, why isn't she here? And the counsel says, I don't know why. So I think there, if we are to make anything of the objection, it is, should the court have proceeded to default over the objection of counsel? And in this case,
I think— If we agree with you on that point, we'd be sharpening our pencils and publishing on that point. What would you see as a syllabus point?
As far as the, with respect to the objection or proceeding over the objection of counsel?
Yes. Under Rule 18. I mean, in a way, I'm hearing you say that if a parent fails to appear, that matters can be readily, summarily disposed of.
Well, I don't necessarily agree that it's gonna be readily or summarily opposed of or disposed of. I think in this case, Mr. Coulter testified that the facts were accurate simply because the petition wasn't admitted into evidence.
What facts were accurate though? What facts? What facts did you say were accurate?
The facts that within the June 23rd, 2020 petition that he filed.
But the petition wasn't introduced as an exhibit, so we don't have those facts as a part of our record evidence as a reviewing court.
Well, again, in anticipation of that question, I think if you look to Nazar v. Nazar, again, a default issue, the court there on default found that the evidence in the record includes respondents' pleadings, deposition, and transcript of the default hearing. So I think under Nazar that this court does have the respondents' pleadings, or I'm sorry, in this case, the county's pleadings, which include the petition that was filed with the court. So I
before
think
I forget
court,
to ask you, if we disagree with you and we agree with Mother, what do you see happening as far as the resolution?
Well, I think in this case,
or is it something to be remanded?
I think it would be remanded for additional findings of fact regarding the specifically with respect to Mr. Coulter. I think additional findings, if the court deems that the petition was not offered into evidence, I think the findings of remanding for findings of fact would be more appropriate in this case. I think remand or completely dismissing the petition is.
Are you suggesting that the district court has the, wait a minute, let me restate that. Are you suggesting that a remand would allow the district court to reopen the record?
I think in this case it should.
Why?
I think, why? Because the testimony, at least from Ms. Moriarty, which indicates that the mother was in complete, as Judge Smith indicated, thwarting any efforts to really keep in contact with social services. And so there is concern for this child. And so dismissing the petition entirely would not serve the child's interest at all in this point, in this case. I think remanding, allowing the court to reopen the record to, if necessary, if this court believes that the petition was not properly admitted into evidence or that those facts are.
If we reversed the CHIPS adjudication, if that was the result of this hearing, why wouldn't the case go back to what its prior status was before the CHIPS trial? In other words, whether there was protective custody, whatever the situation was.
I think that's the alternative. Because if there's not going to remand for findings of fact or reopening the record, I do think that what was the stage immediately prior to default, and I think that would be the most appropriate if it's not going to remand for additional findings of fact, is to place this matter immediately in the procedural stage as it was before default, which is scheduled for a pretrial, and allow the mother to appear.
Why counsel would, I mean, I understand, let's assume that the earlier order subject to protective supervision, that there was concern that was being thwarted. I could imagine there being some motion on that or so forth, even though the case hadn't gotten to its final stage of adjudicating the CHIPS issue, but the county chose to go forward here to get to the ultimate question of whether of the CHIPS issue. I mean, why would it go to a pretrial stage? I mean, the county chose to in fact go to trial on it to actually get to the ultimate issue. And if we were to reverse on that ultimate issue, why would we go back to a pretrial stage? I having trouble understanding why it wouldn't just resolve this case because the county chose to go forward.
I mean, in other words,
it didn't need to go forward in default. It could have just still gone, you know, treated as a pretrial where the parent didn't show and not go forward and then actually get to the, you know, main event later as scheduled, but it chose to go forward. So why doesn't that, if we find that the evidence, either that the findings were not sufficient or there's not sufficient evidence even to support findings that would justify it, why doesn't that end the matter?
And by end the matter, you mean dismissing the petition?
Yes.
Well, I think then, because we still have prior orders that I believe still remain in effect. So if ultimately the default order is found to be is reversed, then it's either, I still think we have prior orders out there that subject the mother to protective supervision of the child. I think completely dismissing the petition would not be in the interest of justice or in the interest of the minor child, given the at least the facts conveyed by Ms. Moriarty subsequent to.
If that was the case, here's the problem I have with that, because I've went over these scenarios as my colleagues have. Doesn't that put a parent in a situation where the county can continue to try and retry and try and retry a CHIPS adjudication, because it would always, if you fail, it would always go back to where it was?
No,
I mean, you've already leapfrogged. You've been to the EPC, you've got the status hearings and all of that. I mean, it just seems as if you have numerous opportunity to continue to seek that adjudication.
And if I can answer your question, Judge Worthy, thank you. In this case, I don't think it would open up a parent to repeated attempts to adjudicate a child as CHIPS. I think this is a specific case unique to this case. It's a default judgment as a result of the parent's behavior or conduct of not appearing. I think continuing this case is in the best interest of the child. I think that it would not open up Pandora's box, if you will, by subjecting every parent within the state of Minnesota to repeated attempts to adjudicate CHIPS. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And we'll turn back to appellant counsel, is it Vesco Warg?
Vesco Warg, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are a couple points that I would like to address here during rebuttal. First, the issue of the default and the standard that's applicable there, as well as Mr. Swiart's argument regarding the civil cases that were brought forth in his briefs. Those civil cases should not apply here. We are functioning under different rules, different procedures. There are two unpublished cases from the Court of Appeals that talk about that distinction and recognize that distinction. Those are BEM, which is A190811, and In Re Welfare of II, A190133. Again, that distinction is recognized in those cases. I would also direct the court's attention to Rule 2103 of the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure. That rule is pertaining to amended findings, and it says that the question of sufficiency of the evidence to support the findings may be raised whether or not the party raising the question has made in the district court an objection to the findings or has made a motion to amend the order. So the fact that sufficiency of the evidence is brought forth here, regardless of the fact that there wasn't a motion, say, for a new trial here, that question can still be answered by this court. I would also—
So I think, may I just pause on that? I think the argument from the county is that there should have been a Rule 22 motion.
A Rule 22 motion, and I believe—
Relief from order.
Relief from order, Your Honor. My understanding is that would be
a different— It says including a default order, but.
And perhaps that is the case, and Your Honor, even so, this court is still allowed to analyze whether the findings of fact and support the conclusions of law. And here the findings of fact simply do not support the conclusions of law. We do not have findings of fact pertaining to the statutory grounds. we do not know how the court came to this conclusion. All we have is that the court is concerned about mother's lack of contact with the county. That finding in and of itself does not support any of the statutory grounds here. So either way, I believe we still get to the same result, which would be a reversal of this case to the district court. And on that point, I want to readdress the remand question brought up by Judge Werke. While remand is absolutely possible here, we don't believe that that is in any way going to change the outcome. Again, looking at the record here, unless this court reopened the record, which we do not believe is appropriate here, the county decided to proceed in default. They presented the evidence that they have, and that evidence was not sufficient. So when looking at the record as it stands, whether it's now or on appeal later after we remand for further findings, this court could still conclude that that evidence that was offered by the county when they proceeded is not sufficient to support those conclusions. We still do not have statutory bases proven at this hearing. And finally, I want to just readdress your question, Judge Smith, about mother's thwarting of the supervision here. I think what the standard would be to move backwards would be really looking at, was this child in immediate danger? Going back to that EPC question, was this child in immediate danger to remove the child from the care of the mother? And that is essentially our second argument about the disposition and why that is inappropriate here in this case. There wasn't immediate danger. There wasn't actual sufficient evidence to support that endangerment standard. And so it was inappropriate to remove the child from mother's care at this point.
I guess my concern with that as being a standard is if you put a condition on returning and then you just have to keep proving the county endangerment again and again, those conditions seem to become meaningless if the county couldn't just come in and say, well, the condition that was not complied with. I mean, what's the point of putting conditions if they can just be ignored and violated?
I see my time is up. May I answer your question?
Please go ahead and answer.
Sure. And I do understand the court's concern if the conditions are not followed. But at the same time, we are talking in the context of a right of a parent to have custody and control of their child. And when the state intervenes in that, there has to be a reason for that removal. And that reason under the statute is a standard of immediate endangerment. And here we simply don't have that. And I think that is a question that needs to be asked. Is this child in danger before we remove that child from the parent's custody?
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for appearing via Zoom Gov. The briefs were well written and the arguments are extremely helpful to us in reaching our decision. This is a child protection matter, so we will handle it in an expedited fashion and render our decision. Thank you.
Thank you.